A pity she does not exist. A shame he's not a fag. The only girl I ever loved was Andrew and Drag. There is no hope of love for me. From here on I go stag. The only girl I ever loved is Andrew and Drag. Andrew and Drag.
This is Nisa.
And this is Swan.
And you're listening to Ink and Worm on Radio Free Brooklyn. Woo! Today I'm going to be taking the lead as we are here with a good friend of mine, Duncan Flaster.
Hello.
Hi. So I'm reading off of his Facebook page right now. He's gay, he's cute, he plays the ukulele, he writes award-winning plays and composed music, and takes photos and sometimes acts if you twist his arm. He also reviews theater. He does a lot of stuff. So thank you so much for being here.
Glad to be here. It's exciting.
Yeah. So I first met Duncan because I was in one of your plays.
That's right.
Yeah, this was years ago. This was in the long, long agos. The before times?
Yeah. 4 years ago now?
Three, I think. Three, yeah, 2013. Yeah. Yeah, it was 1460
sketches of your left hand.
Thank you. Wait, say that again.
The title of the play was 1460 Sketches of Your Left Hand.
Yes.
And the premise was?
It was about artists. And I was actually listening to WTF when he had an artist friend of his on. And the artist was saying that when he was in art school, one of their things was to draw a picture of their hand every day. And so I did the math, and like a picture of your hand every day for 4 years in art school would be 1460 sketches. I did not take leap years into account, so the title is incorrect.
Oh, no.
But
by a couple of sketches. Yeah.
That's probably accurate for the show, though.
But it works better, I think, than like 1462.
Yeah.
I liked the nice even number. So yes, you are a playwright.
Yes, I am.
I'm going to just jump right in and ask you about your new project before then skirting about backwards and asking you about playwriting in general and about your work. So you have a new, like a play reading going up, correct?
Yes, on November 4th, the Dramatists Guild has a Friday night Footlights thing where if you're a member, and I am a member of the Dramatists Guild, you can once a year check out their big space and have a reading of whatever you're working on for and invite the public. And so I'm doing that. And it's a new piece called The Thing That Kills Me. And it's inspired by the Orlando shootings.
Yeah. So I know that we had talked previously, like before the show started, and you don't like to really talk about work before it's finished. I don't know if this is finished and if you can talk about it.
Well, it's still in a very first draft stage. Elephant Room Productions in Philadelphia just did a reading of it yesterday morning.
Oh, wow.
And they're going to send me a recording of it and their feedback, which I haven't received yet. And then I'm going to rewrite it a little bit before the actual reading. But yeah, it's I took like all of the stuff we heard about Omar Mateen through stories in the newspaper and other things like that, and sort of tried to put myself where his head was at. And with the amazing kind of media we have today, I found pictures of his bedroom and, like, the books he was reading and all kinds of, which most of them are available on Kindle, and I read those, and I did, like, a lot of research into what that might be like, and I made more of a, most of my plays are not usually that dark, but this one got...
Yeah, I'm curious, like, what kinds of general things still stand out to you?
Well,
are there any particular things?
The craziest thing was the pictures of his apartment. He had a small child, and there was all of this Star Wars stuff. I mean, like, they really cared about their kid and, like, gave him all kinds of great stuff. But it was just, like, these Darth Vader sheets, and it just never occurred to me. It really humanized his family for me and how strange that was. And I just tried to empathize with putting myself sort of in his shoes, which I don't agree with what he did, and I don't think he was a good... I don't think he was justified in what he did, but... there's a lot of stuff
doing more than what most people have done, which is just like rage or defend, you step into it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And try and really.
Yeah. And like all of the theories that some people say have now been disproved by the FBI, that he was actually gay, was having affairs with some of the people who went to that bar regularly that he shot up, and who knows? So I put all of those together and tried to like make a complex picture of a disturbed man.
Oh, that sounds really great.
Yeah, I hope it'll be interesting at least.
At the very least.
Yeah.
That's something that's very powerful, especially considering what I love about a lot of your work is that it does come from this. Trying to think of the right word, where the lead characters aren't characters we see most of the time.
Yes.
So that's, I think, it works in well with, I guess, the rest of your repertoire in a way that I wouldn't have expected previously.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, I think that's, like, one of my guiding things as a playwright is to write plays about people you don't get to see.
Mm-hmm.
That I'm second-generation queer. My mother came out as a lesbian when I was 10 years old and divorced my father. And I feel like I have a unique perspective on the world and especially on gay issues that I feel like nobody else is writing about.
Yeah.
Well, what appeals to me in your story already is just like I feel like you have this tendency to try and see something without judgment.
Oh, absolutely.
It's kind of a vibe I'm getting and...
I always try to like let the audience make the judgment. I just like present characters and let the audience draw from it what they will.
Well, that's really great. And once again, what day is that going up?
It's November 4th.
Cool, November 4th, yeah. And we can put links, I guess, to the if you send
so
us.
So November 4th, where?
It's going to be in Manhattan at the Dramatists Guild room. I'm not totally sure where it is yet because they just moved to a different section, so they opened up a different room. So it'll all be up on my website soon, and I'll be making a Facebook event for it.
Oh, great, great. We'll make sure to post that.
And free or?
Yes, it's free.
We have to bring flowers.
Flowers and candy would be
whiskey.
Delightful, but not necessary.
I think always bring flowers and candy, guys.
I prefer candy.
Just wherever you go.
What if you actually came like with something everywhere you showed up? I think about that sometimes and I'm like, oh, that'd be like you're the person that came and always bring something. But then I don't actually do it.
I know.
I know a girl who brought candy everywhere with her. She went and she'd say, M&M's make friends, and would like pass them out to people.
Oh, that's really sweet. Yeah. I always want to be that person. And then I think people would think I'm weird. And then,
I remember that I don't actually want to engage with most people. And I'm like, oh, that's right.
That too.
And a lot of people were suspicious of people handing out free
candy.
Stuff too.
Yeah, yeah, right.
Candy, eat it.
They're like, what is this? Why?
All right.
But that sounds really great. And I'm really excited to check that out.
Thank you.
Along this path, I suppose, I have been wanting to ask you, your plays tend to push the boundaries of sexuality.
Yes.
Specifically sexuality on stage, if you could just speak to that in general.
Well, I think it's, again, not something people usually talk about. Like, there's a lot of, I think, shame and stuff around sexuality that the more people talk about, the more education there is about stuff, I think it's better for people to see.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess, so my experience in the play 1460. I just want to say 1460 sex sketches.
That's fine.
Which could also work. There was a lot of just nudity.
Yes.
On stage, which is something that, especially for a small theater space, like I hadn't really been part of before. And I thought that that was very, I want to say liberating, but I feel like that's a stereotypical word.
I think for whatever, like, in that, just because it's liberating doesn't mean it's not powerful. Like, you seek to recreate experiences that feel like that.
Yeah, and it was casual nudity, too. It wasn't, there were obviously moments of more intense nudity.
Sure.
As I recall. But it was, there was, like, just a penis, which is, yeah.
Well, I'm curious, like, maybe this is a weird question, but, like, doing sexual acts to other characters on stage, is that, like, something that...
No, well...
I had to simulate...
Yeah, I mean, it's all simulated. We don't actually, like, have sex on stage.
That becomes a different story once that happens.
But, like, with a fight choreographer, you, like, bring somebody in to sort of just arrange how that'll all work out and how it will affect the audience. Yeah, I don't think I have any actual sex scenes so much. A lot of the,
like,
stuff in...
It's not sexy, it's just nudity.
Well, it's, or... some of it's sexy. I mean, a lot of the stuff in 1460 sketches, the two main characters were both artists who went to college together. One of them was gay, one of them was straight, and the gay one had a big crush on the straight one, but was also not taking his medication, and so the straight one made a deal with him that if he would take his pills, he'd, like, show him his butt or whatever, as just, like, incentive. And so there was a lot of sort of frat guy stuff about it. But then there was also scenes where they were both artists and they got another man who was dating Nace's character to model for them. Yeah. And he was just completely nude and then turned around and gave a speech to the audience, gave a monologue where he was just completely naked talking about.
Yes. Yeah. That's what I was talking about the casual nudity, where it's just kind of like, this is the human body.
Yeah. Look at it.
Look at it for 5-10 minutes while he talks.
I like it. I approve.
Yeah. Yeah. That one was a really great play, and I really enjoyed being in it.
That was great having you in it. It was a great show.
It was. Yeah. It was a lot of fun. It was part of the Unfringe Festival back in 2013.
Yeah.
Which isn't that long ago, but feels long, long ago. cool. So I'm also going to ask you about the Underpants Godot, which just went up.
Yeah, we did that in the Unfringed Festival in 2015 and won Best Play in that. And then the Secret Theater, who does the Unfringed Festival, liked it so much, they brought it back for 2 weekends at the end of September.
Yeah. So I'm going to ask you for a quick, like, synopsis of that one.
Sure. It's about a director who wants to do Waiting for Godot, but with hot guys in their underwear instead of old men. And someone, a representative from the Beckett estate, shows up to tell him why he's not allowed to do that. And so the play ends up being a conversation about adaptation and how far a director's idea can take a play before it's not the same play anymore. And it was a really interesting play, kind of inside baseball for a lot of theater people.
Yeah.
But people who weren't familiar even with Waiting for Godot really seemed to enjoy it as well.
I love the premise. And if I'm not mistaken, the Beckett Foundation, they do tend to be a little bit like...
Oh, yeah. They're very draconian. He tried to shut down a 1980s production of Endgame because it's set in the script in just a plain room with two windows. And there was a production done in Boston, I think, that was set in a bombed out subway station in sort of like a post-apocalyptic world. And Beckett tried to have it shut down because he was saying it's not the play that he wrote. And also one of the character's parents was played by an actor of a different race. And Beckett said that brought up ideas of miscegenation that distracted from the real themes of the play, that it would just, like, make the audience confused. And
That makes me want to ask what your perspective is on that, both of you, as being more engaged in that community. Like, what things can you change and what things...
Well, I mean, that's why I wrote the play. I mean, there's like a lot of...
To confront the challenge.
Ideas about it. Like, you can do that with Shakespeare. You can take, because it's in the public domain, you can take it and change the gender, change... I did an amazing As You Like It a few years ago where we changed the gender of two of the characters. And Olivia became Oliver, and we conflated Corin, who is this shepherd that Touchstone runs into early in the play, with Audrey, who is the shepherdess that Touchstone runs into and eventually marries, and made them one character. So Touchstone sort of became a gay character and gave Corin Audrey a bigger arc throughout the play. And so at the end of the play, we had four couples all getting married at the same time, because Shakespeare, and two of them were heterosexual and two of them were gay, and it turned out to be a really cool, affirming production.
Sounds like that sounds like a really interesting take on it. Which play is that?
That's Rosalind and Orlando.
Okay, thank you. I always get the Twelfth Night confused with As You Like It, I want to say. Yeah, because they're very similar in concept and yet very different.
Yes.
They both deal with cross-dressing and with falling in love with the wrong person. And comedy ensues. and especially that play seems like it's open to it, which is pretty cool.
Yes.
I personally, as far as taking plays and putting them in different places, I think that that's one of the most exciting things that could happen. I love immersion theater. I love theater in spaces that it's not supposed to be done in. The thing that drives me crazy is when it's done for like no reason, like the 100th version of Romeo and Juliet set in like a warring like
anything.
No, just like they always set it in like the ghetto, and it's like two gangs who won't get along, and I'm like, no, I get it. I get it. You're trying to equate it to modern love story. We get it. We're good.
See, of all the things I know of Shakespeare, Romeo and Juliet is probably my personal, like, least favorite.
Mm.
And a lot of people...
I have such an argument against that. But here's my thing. It's about the parents. If you see Romeo and Juliet as a love story between, like, the two kids, yeah, it gets kind of like, it's like, okay, fine. But if you focus on the parents, they're the ones who have the tragic story, because they're the ones who start off really high and then fall to a great like depth. They lose their only children in a really tragic way. So if you track that story through the arc of the parents, it's beautiful.
All right.
I'll consider that if and when I ever expose myself to Romeo and Juliet again.
And I have to say, a couple years ago, I saw a production where Romeo and Juliet were cast age appropriate.
Uh-huh.
And seeing them as like a 13-year-old, it made so much sense.
I'm sure if I saw that, just because I think I secretly love being uncomfortable, and that seems like something that would make me uncomfortable, which would like make me want to. That's oddly enough what my writing went to this morning or this afternoon when we were writing, just like stepping into something that's like, what is like, I don't know. That draws me in just because there is this element. I think Crumb did it in his illustrated version of Genesis when he was like, here's what happened in the Bible, but like actually like visual representations of like sodomy and like all the things that happen in there, and it just makes it much more uncomfortable to be like, oh, that's what we're talking about.
When we mention all those things.
Yeah.
Old days, priests used to fan themselves while reading the Bible because it got so spicy.
Yes.
Is that true?
Yes, it is.
The Song of Songs has some heavy stuff in there.
I mean, a lot of them have some heavy things. Yeah. Like, even if you try to like dummy it down just for kids, there's a lot
of what am I?
Like, David had like all these wives like killed this guy just so he could marry his wife. Oh, it gets so dirty. Mm-hmm. The original dirty play. Let me see. I'm looking at my notes right now. I'm sorry.
Okay.
I'm like trying to be smooth about it, and I'm definitely not smooth. It's too far away, and I might need glasses. Oh, no.
You could zoom your screen up more, too. That's always an option.
What are elements of producing that you find difficult? Because I find that you produce a lot of your, or find venues for a lot of your work, right?
Yeah, I would prefer not to produce if possible, but... it's hard to get theater companies to look at one's work, obviously. And so I've done a lot of productions of my plays, the original versions, just to get the word out there that I'm here, I'm doing stuff. I've done a lot of them in festivals, such as the Midtown International Theater Festival, the Unfringed, where we did 1,460 sketches and
Underpants
Godot. And that makes things a lot easier. It's like producing with training wheels because they give you lights and a soundboard and stuff that's already set up in a theater along with a bunch of other shows. And so you will only get like 4 to 5 performances, but it's a lot simpler.
Yeah. Well, I find that really inspiring as somebody who has like such a hard time kind of following through with a lot of my own work, that you create these pieces and then are the like supporter and champion for them as you continue forward. Just saying, like I'm mad props.
Well, thank you. I when I gave up acting for writing plays like as my main thing, I decided that I really had to go for it, otherwise there would be no point. That there's nobody out there gonna like necessarily produce for me, and I had to do it all myself. So
yeah. And you've even directed your work. Do you find that challenging?
It depends on the script. There are some plays that I write and I know exactly what I want, and other plays where I'm like, I'm not sure how this is gonna work, let's give it to another director. And I've worked with some great people through the years, but a lot of people have said that they prefer the ones that I direct, that there's more of a vision, like a pure vision of what the play should be.
Mm-hmm.
Than when it's filtered through some other director's ideas. But I do love collaborating with the
directors.
Are you ever upset with some, like, a director's decision?
Oh, yes. Yes.
Okay, good. I'm like, oh, that's so nice.
No, well, there was a play that I worked on a while ago where the director added a prologue and epilogue to the piece where it was just
isn't that writing?
No, it was movement. It was all...
Oh.
It was sort of like a dance piece which implied the characters were all waking up at the beginning of it, then doing the play. Then at the end, they all sort of went back to sleep again, which kind of made it feel like the play was a fairy tale that never actually happened, which it was set in ancient Greece and sort of had a mythic quality about it, but it wasn't quite what I wanted to say with the play.
Yeah. But that's, I guess, the challenging thing about being about playwriting in general is then you have to release it to the world.
Yes.
Yeah. Unless you want to be Bertolt Brecht and his company and fight people down who do it in a way that you don't agree with.
Yeah, Václav Havel, who was president of Czechoslovakia and also a playwright, said the best way to get people to do your play the way you want is to become president. So I'm working on that next.
Oh,
oh my goodness.
Really. I don't want politics.
No, could you imagine? No. It's always the worst. Although at this point.
Well, enough said.
Yeah, I know, right? Like, we can go further with that, but I think I will calm down. Did you ever have any actual problems with the Brecht people, by the way? With Underpants Godot, or is at this point is
oh
are
Beckett
they...
Beckett not
Beckett
Brecht,
not Brecht sorry
no I didn't I don't know if anybody even like told them about it, but I did get an email from some people who came to see the show and just loved it, who were huge Beckett fans, one of whom had worked on an edition of Brecht's plays, like she designed the cover or something like that, but it was she. They just loved the play and said a lot. The stuff I staged seconds of the play while they were like trying to show the representative from the Beckett estate in the show what they were trying to do. So there was like sections of it that were actually like staged, but then they said that some of those were staged better than some of the versions they'd seen in legit productions.
Well, that's exciting.
Yeah, that was very. It was
good
very
job.
Very nice letter.
Yeah. Just a reminder, you're listening to Radio Free Brooklyn. I'm going to throw this out here. I'm just going to read it from the page.
Okay, that's a lot of reading.
I know, it is.
Can read.
I can just jump to it. There's visit the shop to buy, sell, the shop upstairs, which now sells.
Okay, yeah. So what happened is we used to be the bike shop radio station, but now we're like the record store radio station.
Which makes more sense in my mind.
Which makes more sense, but it's like less exclusive. Everyone was excited about bikes. But records are cool too, and you can come see what records are here above the studio.
What?
Yeah.
Yeah, visit the shop to buy, sell, and trade your favorites 7 days a week from 12 to 8, or Shop online anytime at www.secondhandrecordsnyc.com.
And I don't know if you're aware, but records are in right now.
They're so in.
If you want to be doing what the cool kids are doing, I think maybe you should get some records.
I feel like I'm retro enough for records because I keep adding www to websites when you don't need to add that.
Google's Nisa. Like, go
nobody
it.
Cares. Why? For a while, I would only do the www, and I forgot to add the .com when I would type in.
You'd be like, why is this not working? That's funny.
Yeah. Also, feel free to donate to Radio Free Brooklyn's GoFundMe?
I think we have a Patreon.
Patreon. I knew it was one of those.
I'm a big fan of Patreon in general, but yeah, you can get on Patreon, support us. $1 a month is $12 a year. That's like a cocktail, and it allows you access to the community, which is a really eclectic interesting
community
group of people. So yeah.
Cool. So now that little bumper is thrown out there, how did you get into playwriting? You said that at a certain point you had just stopped acting altogether and decided to focus in on.
I trained as an actor and intended to do that for most of my life, but I always in college, I took like one or two writing classes, and people are like, "You're really kind of good at this," and I was like, "Oh, thanks." But,
you wanted to act?
Yes, and I still enjoy acting. And every once in a while, somebody will ask me to come be in one of their plays, and I'll be like, "Okay." But I felt like the plays that I was doing didn't represent my experience, like that. The plays that I wanted to be in didn't exist yet, and I felt like I was the only one who would be able to write them. And there's a Tom Robbins quote where he says basically being an artist is making something that only you can conceive of and then being able to show it to other people so they can see what it is you believe in, basically.
Tom Robbins is one of my favorite authors.
Oh, he's fantastic.
I have on my left shoulder, I'm going to eventually have a piece of tattoos, one from each, like one symbol from each of his books.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's a process. But I'm a big fan of Tom Robbins. And nice. I can't always articulate why, because he rambles a lot. But...
Wow. I think that's part of his charm.
Yeah, but then he says things that are like that, and you're like, oh, yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's a really great...
That's great. Write the things only you can write.
So
yes.
Coming to that as a writer, that's so validating for me to hear you say that experience, because I feel like I hear people talk about that compulsion, and I feel like I'm just compelled to write things. For me, it's not necessarily because I'm wanting to like maybe process issues, but I do love this like I feel like people are like, I wrote the book that I wanted to read. So when you find those things and like find that path of like, this is something that doesn't exist that I can bring in, if that makes sense. Yeah. I don't know. It's like a writer. I'm like, that's so cool that is how it works, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And especially with your plays, once again, I kind of love that you include so many different cultures, so many different sexuality.
Where did you grow up? Do you mind me asking?
Oh, South Florida.
Oh, nice. Ah.
My parents are from New Jersey. I was born in California, but my parents were only there for a year. Then they moved back to New Jersey, had my brother. We all moved down to Florida. My parents got divorced. My father and his third or fourth wife, depending on how you want to count it, are living down in Florida still. Oh, but my mom and her wife and their adopted children moved to New Jersey, but just moved back down to St. Augustine, Florida, and now own an Irish shop down there.
An Irish shop?
Yeah, memorabilia and stuff. It's been down in St. Augustine for years, but they just took it over from the people who've been running it for years.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. So if we...
It's called House of Ireland. A little plug.
So if you're down in Florida, please stop by.
Yeah. St. Augustine is a beautiful town.
I've never been.
It's one of the earliest settled places in the United States because the Spaniards got there and...
They're like, this is nice.
Yeah, this is great. And one of the oldest buildings, the Castillo de San Marcos... is there, and there's a lot of pirate stuff and a lot of really cool beach town.
Ooh.
It's a beautiful area. Just was recently hit by the hurricane, which was not good.
Right. But,
they seem to be recovering okay.
That leads me to ask a different question that I've asked before, but I like to hear the answer. How do you feel like geography has shaped your work? Has it?
I'm always, I don't know. I'm always told that I smile too much to be living in New York. And I feel that's that sort of laid back Florida-ness that
everyone
I grew
waving
up with.
To everyone?
Yeah, well, not quite that. I mean, it was near Fort Lauderdale, so not, oh. It wasn't that nice.
See, I lived in a small city in Georgia, but there was this charming thing of like, you know. Mm. Everyone was so friendly.
Yeah, we went to New Orleans for a friend's wedding recently, and there were people, my brother and I were standing out on the sidewalk outside the hotel, and a gentleman walked by. He's like, good morning, gentlemen. How are you? And we're like, what do you want from us?
Get away.
What's happening?
People still do that.
Yeah, it was charming.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, see, being from California, I don't know people just talking to me in the streets. Mm. California is weird.
Yeah.
Because nobody is used to other people. So whenever you're forced to interact with them, you do it badly. I never realized it until I was in New York. Because in New York, it's there's this system. It's like you have this much distance from one another.
Like
you know,
we all understand these unwritten rules.
Exactly. But in California, like grocery shopping, I almost yelled at some people because they'll just take up the entire aisle and it's wider than most aisles. And they'll just like walk back and forth between these two things. And I'm like, what is wrong with you? You make up your mind as you go. There's a system.
People keep telling me I should go to California and go to LA. And I'm just like, I would probably hurt people.
Yeah.
Although I think that LA and Florida have that same kind of chillness
Maybe
to them.
Nice.
Yeah.
When I get hired on some TV show or whatever.
New York,
like that
New York
yeah, there you
benefit
go.
Benefit from a little bit more chill.
Yeah.
Everyone's yeah. so freaking intense sometimes. You're like, whoa.
I think there's something about living in constant, like, nice weather that just, that gives you
mellows
something.
You out.
Yeah, mellows you out. I think that's what the California, Florida, like, miracle is.
Absolutely. I think part of the intrigue of that question is I feel like some writers, and I'm sure it's the same for playwrights, don't always realize like how their experiences have shaped their stories until they write the story, and then it's like, oh, that was like or maybe you don't even make the connection and someone will come by and make it later, but I just find that interesting to try and speculate where things came from.
Yeah. Okay, so now I'm gonna go ahead and open up to the writing that we did before.
Oh.
What? So I'm going to invite, we did a piece, a free write previously on The Soul's Expression by Elizabeth Barrett Browning. So if you would like to read what you wrote, we now invite you to.
Do you want to go?
Well, I can go first if everyone is feeling.
Well, I referenced mine and I think it was just in talking about stepping towards things. So I'll go ahead and go first. Darkness speaks to me as fall approaches and the leaves turn and drop to the ground. I seek rest. Energy is spent in conservative and attentive ways. I like sitting in darkness with my own thoughts. I love feeling my body in space and moving in ways to access the dark and the light. It is presence, awareness. Sometimes it is looking at what scares you, and sometimes it is taking a step towards it.
Thank you.
Nice. Yeah. All right. The world, the soul, the universe, I can't write about everything at once. The entirety of human existence should be found in even the smallest expression, but so often I stumble and halt, stumbling over myself, trying to contain it all. On one hand, it's noble, and Melville said, American, to aim for an epic scope, but how do I do that with my own hands? Be bold.
Mm. Ooh, thank you.
I love that. Thank you.
Yeah, that was lovely. I like the unintentional, but worked with it, stumble.
I wrote something else there. I'm not quite sure what that word was. I have terrible handwriting.
I can sympathize with that.
I like the stumble.
I try so hard to be understood, but I do not understand myself. Like growing up and being an adult, so much of what I put out is fake it until it's real. So what I make always feels fake or forced or shallow, because it is what I can create when creation is what I force. But the more I plead to be understood, the more with this surface work, the more I begin to understand myself, the less it is fake. So I make more until maybe I can announce this is me with full confidence.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yeah. All right. Thank you so much. And that has been Poetry Corner. No. once again, that was The Soul's Expression by Elizabeth Barrett Browning. So if you want to read the poem and do your own free write... I'm speaking now to the people in the ether, the theoretic listeners well, of this world.
And I think it also has value to just give a quick, I feel like it's been a while. So this is a practice that came from my friend Nan in Utah, and it's a really flow-based. So you just kind of like listen to a poem, grab what speaks to you, and use that as your starting point, and then you just go with it. And even if you start writing, God, I don't know what I'm writing, I don't know what, but just like writing. And you can set the time if you're comfortable with 3 minutes, 11 minutes, like you can just like go and write. So that's the intention, is just to like go. And it doesn't have to be good, because you're just like...
just writing.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really fun. I enjoy having the opportunity to do that, because I don't either any otherwise.
Yeah.
Told you, too much caffeine. I do not know words now.
Words are hard sometimes.
Words are so, I think in pictures. And so I always have to like translate images to words, and it's really difficult sometimes.
Sometimes the transfers.
It just doesn't. And then I can't draw. So it's not like I can be like, oh, I'll just express myself in imagery. No. Unless it's like a stick figure. Speaking of images, notice that smooth transition.
Nice.
Naughty Jewish Boys calendar. I would be amiss if I did not bring that up.
Yeah, I started that 3 years ago now. I sort of started as a joke on Facebook, where I was like, you know, they have these pinup calendars, and I think Jewish dudes are hot. They should really start that. And people are like, yes, you should. And so just to see, I put out an ad on Craigslist looking for models of Jewish guys who might like to model, and got a lot of interesting response. And got picked up by Hebe magazine and Jewschool.org and a whole bunch of other things. And so it sort of started like snowballing that I'm now doing this. And it ended up making a calendar, and now we're in our third year.
Yeah, I need to buy one of those.
Yeah, they're pretty great.
I know.
That's fascinating.
Yeah, we have two editions every year. One regular, which is just guys in their underwear, and one where they're usually naked.
Like a PG-13 and like an R.
Exactly, yeah. Some guys wearing just nothing but a yarmulke and a smile.
I think that's lovely. And I especially loved your reasoning behind doing it, which I'm going to let you express, which is why I'm being so...
Well,
the embrace, like... to empower...
Oh, yeah. It's a lot of Jewish guys feel like the common idea of them is that they're schlubby and not sexy. And I feel like this is empowering to show that, yes, you can be...
You are sexy.
You are sexy.
And then there was some legal drama with that.
Oh, yeah. The first year...
of course. I was like just sitting here being like, there had to be some...
there's a nice Jewish guys calendar out there. Which is sort of a joke calendar where they take nerdy guys and sort of like hold them up as and clothed as just like, these are the guys you could take home to your mother, which is kind of what my calendar is fighting against, is that it's just, my guys are hot, is what I'm saying. And they sent me cease and desist letters the first year, and we got some press out of that. We were in the New York Post and online and a couple of other places, and they eventually stopped sending me letters after I said really don't have a leg to stand on,
there's no similarity.
And I understand it's not like they thought I was infringing on their copyright, that there could be some confusion between our calendars, and
I
understand
misguided
that
misguided traffic being like, oh, what is this?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's what they were concerned about, and so I make it very clear on everything that I do that we're not in any way related to that calendar.
Yeah. And yeah.
And they have like a monthly Mensch calendar out in San Francisco, I believe, and a couple of other things like that. But there's nothing like mine out there.
Yeah, which is really fun. And like kind of
I love the
cute
idea of creating a calendar, because it reminds me of, I'm sure you've seen, there's like a calendar out with firefighters and like puppies and kittens.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, those are tons, yeah.
And I just like want to get them for all my friends because I think they're hilarious. But I was sitting here like, what, like if I had to make a calendar, like, or pick a calendar for myself.
It's just such a specific market, I suppose. But on the other hand, is one that I play to very, I like Jewish boys.
Yeah,
I think they're very cute.
I was thinking about making one now that my mom owns this Irish store of Irish boys, but then I discovered the Irish Farmer's Calendar, which is
already doing that.
Yeah, it's oh my gosh, hot redheads holding animals. I highly recommend
maybe
it.
Maybe I should check this out.
Yeah. I know, right?
I think it's farmerscalendar.com.
This sounds
mine is
so
naughtyjewishboys.com.
If you're interested.
Yeah. Naughty Jewish boy. It makes a really great Hanukkah gift.
Absolutely. And yeah, we have an extra December, so if you give it as a Hanukkah gift, you can start using it immediately.
There you go.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
Double Decembers.
Now you've got all your Christmas shopping done.
I know, right? Like, such a great gift. And I know you were joking about making a bad hombres one.
Oh, yeah, I thought about that, but I figured the joke would be done by the time I could actually produce it. But I had a couple of people like, yes, I will pose for that. And I was like, oh, it's the joke is probably already gone by the time this is.
Yeah.
I don't know. Bad hombres. Was it a moment?
Oh, it's a Trump thing.
Yeah, okay. Trump had.
Yeah,
had
if you say Trump, my brain's like, nope, never mind. Yeah,
during the last debate, along with nasty women, Trump had called out some illegal immigrants as being, quote unquote, bad hombres.
Yeah.
Terrible. Oh, God.
He's a bad, bad man.
He is. I'm so ready for this election to be done. I'm like 2 weeks and counting, guys.
Yeah, let's get Hillary in there.
Oh, my God. Yeah. But seriously.
While we're all holding our breath emotionally.
Yeah, I know. Ugh.
There's people getting PTSD from this election. It's really
this
sad.
Election
I think
is
I'm
hard.
Getting more PTSD from this election than any other, like, hands down.
Yeah, it's...
Last year, shows how political I am. The last election, I was like, I'm not very political, so I'll be the first to admit it. But I was like, you know, whoever has been president hasn't really affected me one way or the other too much on a personal level. And then I'm just watching this being like, oh, my God.
Yeah. Right?
This
would affect. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah.
That's my two cents.
I had to tune off of like my political comedy shows for a while because it was getting too much. Yeah. Once Trump got the nominee, I was out for like 2 months. I was like, no, I'm sorry.
We can't go here.
Can't do it. Can't do it.
Alas. Well, it sounds like you're doing some wonderful things in the world.
I'm trying.
I know.
But you don't talk about current projects that you're working on, but you are working on something.
Yes, I have a couple things on the burner. One that's... exploring Twitter culture and like sort of the stuff that happened with Leslie Jones, but through a more farcical lens, and something about sort of giving up on your dreams, because I love a lot of friends recently who are like, I can't deal with producing theater in New York anymore, and I'm losing my drive, and I want to settle down with a family and have children and not do stuff anymore. And so that's what I have like 15 pages of it, and I haven't even finished it yet, but I don't know if it's the fact that I'm currently single that's like keeping me not
going.
That's keeping me going. I mean, it's like.
I think being single actually is better for your creative life.
I agree.
Yeah. You just have more time and. Oh, yeah.
I feel like this is one of those situations, though, since we're both in relationships we're being where we're being like kind of not bitchy, but like bitchy. Like, oh, my God, if we were single.
If only. I know the grass is always greener.
Yeah.
When you get there and you're like, oh, wait, this is the same grass. Only I just left that grass. That was perfectly fine.
Anyway,
I'm curious about your process then. Do you keep like books of ideas? Do you use computer a lot? Like what kinds of things do you?
I type on the computer, and I usually have a book or an app on my phone that I can like take down notes while I'm on the subway or wherever. And those end up usually getting into plays eventually at some point. I did 5 pages of my play, The Tragedy of Dandelion, in a Moleskine notebook. Just one day I was in a coffee shop and didn't have anything to do. And I was just like, just wrote like the first 5 pages of it, and then went out and typed it up. And
nice.
And then it became a play.
Yay. I do have a question. Where can one buy your plays?
A lot of them are available on indietheaternow.com, which is a sort of the iTunes for plays. Mm. You can read them online there, or you can just email me and... I'm on the National New Play Network. No, the NPX, the National Play Exchange, which is run by the National New Play Network, where if you're on that, you can read them there. You can go to my website, duncanflaster.com, and email me if there's anything that looks interesting to you, if you'd like to read it.
Which I would highly recommend doing. I'm actually probably going to ask you for the Let me see. Hold on. I had it pulled aside.
Tragedy of Dandelion?
Yes. Yes, The Tragedy of Dandelion, because I thought it looked really cool.
That's my all-female, all-iambic pentameter Shakespearean tragedy.
Which is why I was like, ooh.
Yeah, I'm like, ooh, too.
Yeah, we had, it's written for 8 actresses, but we did it with 10 when it was produced a couple years ago. And they play like 40 different roles. And it's about a lesbian princess.
See, and it's really great to find like work like this, which is unique and female. Not all of your plays are female-centric, obviously. Obviously.
To have that piece.
Yeah. But like, yes, exactly. But pieces that aren't something that are out there right now.
Yeah, exactly. That's...
If you're looking for a monologue, just saying. 1460 Sketches has some good ones, too. Yeah.
Which have been published in...
they have been.
The Smith and Krause's Best New Plays. I think they were 2014.
Oh, congratulations. Yeah. That's what we're talking about a little bit on the walkover, of just how you keep getting a lot of attention, but not a lot
but
of
not money,
money,
which is sad.
Yeah. So also, you know...
Yeah, which is, I think, powerful that you keep... This is why I wanted to know about how you were producing your work and everything, because it's one of those things where I think it's a passion that lives, that I'm like very happy to see exist.
Yeah, it gets hard without money, but so do what I can.
Yeah.
Kind of keep pushing through. And yeah, I mean, I guess the ideal would just be to like find sponsors and donors as a playwright, or like,
yeah, or producers. I mean, yeah, it's yeah.
Picked up by bigger names.
I miss the old days where you could just like have somebody pay for everything. You know what I'm talking about? Like back in the 1800s,
that would be great.
Like,
but then you have to like bend your work to what they wanted. But,
yeah,
you
know, that's true.
It's not necessarily a bad thing.
Okay, where you have like an actual like
sponsor. Patron. Yeah, patron. Thank you. Patron. Yeah.
Which is like the whole premise of Patreon is like, let's reinstate that for creatives, but right. You have to have a following for yeah. that to be effective.
But like the Sheen Center is doing something like that now. They're a beautiful, beautiful theater space downtown, brand new like a year or so now, but they're run by Catholics, and they have a vested interest in doing Catholic friendly productions. They just did the Universal Robots by Mac Rogers, which had some religious themes in it, even though he's not particularly religious himself, and so they saw that and were interested in helping them produce it.
That's cool. Yeah. All right, so we usually like to end our show with our thing.
Thing.
You know, this little thing.
Do your thing.
With rapid fire questions.
Uh-oh.
Which aren't actually rapid fire. You know, they can be. So Swan, if you wanted to start.
Oh, shucks, me first. Great. I will steal one of your favorites. I feel like people have a book they read when they were a teenager that like changed them or just like really influenced that transition from child to adult. Mm. Is there a book that comes out in your mind?
The Illuminatus trilogy by Robert Anton Wilson. Oh, not even. The Illuminati Chronicles. I found those first. They're all picturesque novels set in the 16 and 1700s in Italy, and they're mind-blowing stuff.
Nice.
Yeah. Yeah. If you've ever read any Robert Anton Wilson, his Illuminati trilogy was written in the 60s, 70s, and then he wrote the Schrodinger's Cat trilogy, and then the Illuminati Chronicles, and then there's a whole bunch of other amazing books that he wrote.
I'm jealous of you for getting to ask that question, because that was the one I was like, ooh, this would be a great one. Because I feel like most of your plays are books that would be influential during puberty.
Oh, possibly.
Someone yeah. saw this and they're like, I'm different now.
Yeah, it's like one of those types of things where you like embark upon it. You're like, oh my God, how did I not know this about myself? But yeah. Did you want to answer that question, Swan?
I've answered before, but Clan of the Cave Bear was like...
I've answered so many. I have so many. I can't just... But Mad Magazine is the one I'm going to be going with right now. But there are so many other ones. I was a weird kid. What is your favorite brag?
My brag?
Yeah, like if you're at a party or something and you're trying to like show off, what's your favorite brag?
I guess I'm a multi-award winning playwright. Seems like the obvious.
Ooh. Is there something like odd or interesting about you that you're like secretly excited to tell people but you don't really find a way to fit in normal conversation?
Oh, I don't know. I can't think of anything.
Okay. Well,
I mean, being a multiple award winning playwright seems like a really great brag.
That's a thing. That's a total thing. We will hold that.
To be fair.
Yeah, We just had someone come in for the next show, just so you know.
Oh, okay.
I got quiet.
Great. Yeah.
Night.
We don't want anyone to be confused.
Yeah. They're in a few minutes, but you can wait in here or out there.
All right. Cool. Swana, you can go ahead.
Oh, I have another question to ask. If I were to come into your home right now, what books would be out and about?
Oh, well, there'd be my Kindle, which has most of them now. I had a fire a couple of years ago, and I lost a lot of my books.
So tragic.
Yeah, I'm currently reading a biography of David Garnett, who wrote Aspects of Love and a bunch of other novels back in the day.
You keep mentioning people I've never heard of, which is like that rush of like, ooh, something good.
He was sort of ancillary to the Bloomsbury group. He had an affair with Duncan Grant, the painter, had a baby with... No, wait. Duncan Grant had a baby with Virginia Woolf's sister, which David Garnett then later married when he was 50 and she was like 19. And I'm considering writing a play about them.
That sounds interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, that does.
The complexities
of real human relationships.
Yeah. To marry your ex-lover's daughter is awkward, I think.
Yeah, that feels like it would be awkward.
It's like a thing that should... It's taboo, possibly, for you to do.
And yet, if love exists...
Well, the Bloomsbury group was traditionally very polyamorous and fun, but
But there's like an age thing that's just weird.
And nobody told Angelica. Nobody told her that her father and her husband had an affair at some point.
Oh,
it was crazy.
That's weird.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And she wrote a book too, which I'm about to read, which is called Deceived by Kindness, I believe.
You mentioned Kindle, and I want to say more about that just because I do have a lot of people on the show that are like, nope, I read books. So you mentioned kind of had some life circumstances shift that for you, and now you're a fan of the Kindle, or it's just the cheapest way for you to...
Oh, no, I had the Kindle before that. It's just I lost a lot of the hardcover books in the thing. But it's a lot cheaper on the Kindle, and I don't have a problem reading on the Kindle. I know a lot of people feel like hardcover, like the tactile sensation is part of the book, but for me, I just like reading.
Mm. Yeah.
And you can have like 40 books.
Yeah.
It's just like this tiny thing.
I had The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy omnibus back in the day that had like all of the books and Young Zaphod Plays It Safe.
Which is hefty.
And I couldn't read it. I couldn't carry it around. I couldn't take it on the subway.
Yeah.
But as soon as I got my Kindle, I bought it. And I was like, I can read these again. I can take this anywhere.
Yeah. That's really exciting. Yeah. Especially that series. It's one of my favorites.
Yeah. So the Kindles have their place.
Absolutely.
So thank
I
you
love
for...
them.
I like them for reading plays, personally. Because it's a really fast way to just get through the play, and oftentimes you can get plays online for cheap if you...
Yeah. And now the New York Public Library can loan things out to your Kindle, which I've been doing a little bit.
Yeah,
I'm
no
pointing
way
at you.
That's
great.
Like the shit, because I'm like, if you look at my account right now, I owe $4.05 because I don't know how to return things.
Yep. I owe some money to the Public Library as well. To both New York and Brooklyn, because I'm bad at returning things.
I can't go there. Oh, shoot. Oh, I can't go there.
I'm burning all the libraries.
No. Which one do I owe less money?
Swan, did you have an answer to your question?
Oh, my question. Lying about, out and about. I have a book about Alexander Wilson, who was kind of the first person to discover like birds in America and start to catalog and organize and draw them and study their behaviors. It's an interesting book to read, which is like my whole... platform of like you can read about anything if it's interesting writing, so I'm enjoying that.
Nice. For me, I have actually someone who we're mutually Facebook friends with, Queen Nguyen. Nguyen.
Yeah,
I'm really bad at pronouncing.
What? I think it's Goyen.
Goyen.
Yeah.
I'm reading She Kills Monsters. I just finished it today.
That's being done out in Brooklyn somewhere.
Yeah, and his play Viet Gone is off Broadway right now. I babysit for him. I'm excited because I get to see the boys again this Tuesday.
Nice. I hear Viet Gone is amazing.
I know.
People
I'm waiting
about it.
To get my like 30 under 30 from Manhattan Theater Club so that I can go see it. But it still hasn't come in yet, so I might just have to do half price tickets for that. Unless Kui wants to give me free tickets.
No pressure.
All right, so I'm going to ask you one more question, and then that'll probably be all the time we have for. Sio, what is your writing process? Like, what are, like, rituals that you do?
Oh, I used to have rituals, and now I only really go back to them if I'm feeling stuck. But I used to light scented candles, like sort of make the space sacred that way, play specific music. I like classical, Baroque, and sometimes punk rock. Stuff in other languages also helps. And there was a sort of coffee that I would only drink when
this.
I was working.
And then now you don't do any of those things, or only sometimes?
I don't feel like I need to anymore, but sometimes I will, if I need to write, I'll make it like back into that kind of
So do
space
you think
again.
That was like a byproduct of you being more confident as a writer?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I've done a lot of 24-hour play festivals recently, and people are always surprised that I can like crank something out in like 12 hours that people then do the next day. And I feel like I know what I'm doing now as a writer,
that
I'm just like, I go out there and I'm like, this is what's necessary, and I do it.
That's great.
May we all be more like you.
I know, certainly. All right. Well, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks
I'm
for
just
going
to plug you one more time at Duncan Flaster. That's PFLASTER.
That's right.
.com. And Duncan is DUNCA. Whoa. DUNCAN.
Yes.
So DUNCANPFLASTER.com.
Yes.
Thank you.
spell together.
As opposed to Dunkin', like Dunkin' Donuts.
Yes. Which people do all the time. It's not that. It's like the yo-yo or the
yes, exactly.
Mix.
But thank you so much for being here.
And thank you for having me.
A lot of fun. All right. So I'm going to leave you with a word, take it or leave it. And that word is opiah.